Državni izpitni center.
Splošna matura 2013.
Preverjanje slušnega razumevanja.
Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje maturitetne izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine.
Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak.
Rešitve, ki jih pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom, vpisujte v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami.
Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha.
Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Isabel Talks about her quest for a butterfly. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
When my next guest was planning her gap year, the decision about where to go wasn't too difficult, because since the age of 6, Isabel Talks had been yearning to find the rare South American butterfly that had been named after her in a competition run by the World Wildlife Fund. As a result, Isabel, now 19, spent much of last year as a volunteer living and working in different communities in Ecuador when she wasn't tracking down the elusive butterfly Pronophila isabellae. She also visited Bolivia, Peru and the Galapagos Islands. She joins me in the studio. Izzy, first things first, the butterfly. You went to find it in the Podocarpus National Park, which I think was just recently designated as such.
Yes.
What was the place like?
The Podocarpus Park, I mean, it was unlike anywhere I'd ever been in my life. It was completely remote. It wasn't like a national park in England where you go and there's guards and a big office all set up and it's very well looked after. It was in the middle of nowhere. You had to get there sort of using a taxi that wasn't usually going there. And the guards there were very friendly, lovely. But I mean, in the visitor book, there was only about 3 names.
Oh, wow.
And I was one of the only names in it. But that made it more exciting, I think.
And how long did you stay there on the quest?
Well, I actually was there for 8 days in the park and a bit in the surrounding area. I only had limited time to find it.
But I mean, how did you find it? Because I've got a picture of you as a 6-year-old and now as a 19-year-old with the photograph of this wonderful wonderful thing. I mean, how did you go about tracking it down in an area as big as a national park?
Well, I was lucky that I had guidance from the explorer Paul Toyne, who discovered it back when I was younger. And he gave me some advice on what sort of things to look for. And also, at the eco lodge I was staying at, the two people who owned it, Alicia and Orlando, they'd been guides in the Galapagos, and they had a lot of knowledge of the natural area and of the wildlife there. And with their guidance, I was able to look for the right kind of plants, the right altitude, the right markings, the right flight patterns, because they knew so much. Yeah. And I learned so much when I was there.
But I hadn't realised that there were so many. There's something like 40,000 species of butterfly and moths.
Oh, so
there was a huge number, and most of them were in South America.
Yes.
There must have been a lot of false starts as you went
so
around.
So many false starts. I saw so many brown butterflies. So many, and you just follow them for hours trying to track them down, and you get really excited, and then you'd realise, oh, perhaps not actually, that spot was in the wrong place.
Oh, wow. But then eventually you found it.
Eventually I did, actually, on the last day.
Like?
Incredible. It's so hard to explain. It was the relief of it, the excitement of it, all just came out at once, and I just, yeah, it was incredible.
And what was it like? What does it describe the butterfly?
The butterfly. Well, it's about the size of the palm of a hand, so quite big, but not too big.
Yeah.
And it's very well camouflaged. It's a very beautiful brown colour with white spots on it and orange tips on the wing. And yeah, just really beautiful.
And this is the male of the species. Did you find the female?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because they haven't actually found the female yet, not identified it officially anyway. So I could have seen that many times and I'd have no idea if I did see the female. But...
Well, a wonderful, wonderful quest and a successful outcome. Now, you went to Ecuador to do voluntary work with a charity that is actually based in the country.
Yes.
And what were your first impressions on arriving in Ecuador?
Well, I arrived really early in the morning, and the Quito airport was certainly different to other airports I had been to. But I was welcomed immediately. We went to this hostel that the charity knew very well.
Right.
And we were given a traditional corn dish to eat, which was very interesting. And immediately I did feel at home, I have to say. The ladies
When you say were there other volunteers going
yes,
with you?
Yes, there were. I mean, I hadn't met them before, but upon arrival, there were some other young people from England who had come to volunteer as well. And that was great, although quite strange to meet these people early in the morning when you're a bit jet-lagged and a bit confused.
Yeah, sure.
But we became firm friends really soon.
But you spread out around the country to go to different communities. Tell us about where you went to.
Well, the first place I went to was the jungle, a small community sort of who made their money slightly through ecotourism and also through a bit of farming. And that was very, very interesting community. We lived in a hut full of tarantulas and all kinds of bugs and sort of had to help out as you do. And our main project there was to build a reserve for rescued animals.
Okay.
Because many of the animals in the surrounding area, as development's going on, were being killed by farmers or sort of sold as pets.
Now you will hear the recording again.
When my next guest was planning her gap year, the decision about where to go wasn't too difficult, because since the age of 6, Isabel Talks had been yearning to find the rare South American butterfly that had been named after her in a competition run by the World Wildlife Fund. As a result, Isabel, now 19, spent much of last year as a volunteer living and working in different communities in Ecuador when she wasn't tracking down the elusive butterfly Pronophila isabellae. She also visited Bolivia, Peru and the Galapagos Islands. She joins me in the studio. Izzy, first things first, the butterfly. You went to find it in the Podocarpus National Park, which I think was just recently designated as such.
Yes.
What was the place like?
The Podocarpus Park, I mean... It was unlike anywhere I'd ever been in my life. It was completely remote. It wasn't like a national park in England where you go and there's guards and a big office all set up and it's very well looked after. It was in the middle of nowhere. You had to get there sort of using a taxi that wasn't usually going there. And the guards there were very friendly, lovely. But I mean, in the visitor's book, there was only about 3 names.
Oh, wow.
And I was one of the only names in it. But that made it more exciting, I think.
And how long did you stay there on the quest?
Well, I actually was there for 8 days in the park and a bit in the surrounding area. I only had limited time to find it.
But... I mean, how did you find it? Because I've got a picture of you as a 6-year-old and now as a 19-year-old with the photograph of this wonderful wonderful thing. I mean, how did you go about tracking it down in an area as big as a national park?
Well, I was lucky that I had guidance from the explorer Paul Toyne, who discovered it back when I was younger. And he gave me some advice on what sort of things to look for. And also at the Eco Lodge I was staying at, the two people who owned it, Alicia and Orlando, they'd been guides in the Galapagos, and they had a lot of knowledge of the natural area and of the wildlife there. And with their guidance, I was able to look for the right kind of plants, the right altitude, the right markings, the right flight patterns, because they knew so much. Yeah. And I learned so much when I was there.
But I hadn't realised that there are so many. There's something like 40,000 species of butterfly and moths.
Oh, so
there was a huge number, and most of them were in South America.
Yes.
There must have been a lot of false starts as you went
so
around.
So many false starts. I saw so many brown butterflies. So many, and you just follow them for hours trying to track them down, and you get really excited, and then you'd realise, oh, perhaps not actually, that spot was in the wrong place.
Oh, wow.
But that
then
kept
eventually
it
you found it.
Eventually, I did, actually, on the last day.
Like?
Incredible. It's so hard to explain. It was the relief of it, the excitement of it, all just came out at once, and I just, it was incredible.
And what was it like? What does it describe the butterfly?
The butterfly. Well, it's about the size of the palm of a hand, so quite big, but not too big.
Yeah.
And it's very well camouflaged. It's a very beautiful brown colour with white spots on it and orange tips on the wing. And yeah, just really beautiful.
And this is the male of the species. Did you find the female?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because they haven't actually found the female yet, not identified it officially anyway. So I could have seen that many times and I'd have no idea if I did see the female. But...
What a wonderful, wonderful quest and a successful outcome. Now, you went to Ecuador to do voluntary work with a charity that is actually based in the country.
Yes.
And what were your first impressions on arriving in Ecuador?
Well, I arrived really early in the morning, and the Quito airport was certainly different to other airports I had been to. But I was welcomed immediately. We went to this hostel that the charity knew very well.
Right.
And we were given a traditional corn dish to eat, which was very interesting. And immediately I did feel at home, I have to say. The ladies
when
there,
you say were there other volunteers going
yes,
with you?
Yes, there were. I mean, I hadn't met them before, but upon arrival there were some other young people from England who had come to volunteer as well. And that was great, although quite strange to meet these people early in the morning when you're a bit jet-lagged and a bit confused.
Yeah, sure.
But we became firm friends really soon.
But you spread out around the country to go
yes.
to different communities. Tell us about where you went to.
Well, the first place I went to was the jungle, a small community sort of who made their money slightly through ecotourism and also through a bit of farming. And that was very, very interesting community. We lived in a hut full of tarantulas and all kinds of bugs and sort of had to help out as you do. And our main project there was to build a reserve for rescued animals.
Okay.
Because many of the animals in the surrounding area, as development's going on, were being killed by farmers or sort of sold as pets.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Shirley Williams about her childhood. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Shirley was born in 1930 and spent the early part of her childhood in this elegant Chelsea home.
How much has it changed?
Oh, hugely. I mean, for one thing, it's very much more light. Houses in those days in Chelsea were mostly quite dark. People hadn't got the idea of opening them out in the way that they have now. Chelsea in those days didn't just pretend to be inhabited by artists, it was inhabited by artists. So because it was a quiet street, artists used to actually paint with their easels up in the road. And the fun of it would be essentially looking at the curious characters that wandered down the street. I mean, artists who were tremendously showing off by wearing great berets on the side of their heads, or if they were women artists, huge hats. There was a street life which was very lively. I suspect now there's much less of a street life.
As a child, Shirley was immersed in political life, literally from the age of one, when she was pushed in a pram by her father during his campaign as a Labour candidate in the 1931 election. She became a Labour MP in 1964 and went on to hold ministerial positions in the Wilson and Callaghan governments, including Secretary of State for Education, where she is best remembered for her efforts to extend comprehensive schools. In the early 80s, she famously resigned from the Labour Party to form the SDP with three other colleagues. Together, they became known as the Gang of Four. This year, aged 81, she was instrumental in persuading the government to rethink large elements of its NHS reforms. Shirley grew up with success. The accomplishments of her left-wing intellectual parents, the political scientist George Catlin and the feminist writer Vera Brittain, dominated the Chelsea house.
My mother had just written Testament of Youth, which was her most famous book and which sold many millions of copies about the First World War. My father was travelling extensively lecturing, so they lived a fairly high-profile life. They were both quite, well, she particularly was quite a famous person.
So she was the breadwinner. She earned more than your father.
I think it was a huge discrepancy, but there was certainly a discrepancy. She would go on quite long, roughly sort of month-long speaking tours in the United States, wonderfully formal. I mean, she would travel by a Cunard liner. I remember we children used to go down to Southampton to see her off. People would come up and graciously offer my mother their books to be signed and that kind of thing.
The drawing room where we're in now, were there gatherings, parties where well-known people would gather?
Two sets, really. And tea was a great place to be hospitable. So quite often you'd have a small gathering, maybe only another friend or three or four friends, who would come and arrive at about four. Then you would have party parties, which would be at six, cocktail parties. Quite a few people would come to parties here, other writers and so forth. Quite a lot of women were emerging at that time, Phyllis Bentley, Storm Jameson, Rebecca West, well-known names of the 30s. And so my mother's feminism and her being an author mingled, so to speak. The two things came together.
One thing that struck me, you said in your autobiography that you knew your mother was very well known and very respected, but you weren't sure she was widely liked.
That's right. My mother was very candid. She was somebody who was unable to be anything except honest. literally unable to be. What that meant was, for example, if she met a fellow author and she thought he'd written a terrible book, she would say so. This is not exactly tactful.
So there was this very busy, serious-minded woman. How was she as a mother? Did she have a lot to do with you as a mother?
No, not really. Probably around about 6 o'clock when my mother stopped working and my father stopped working, we would come up to this drawing room and talk to them for maybe half an hour about what was happening at school and about our friends and so on. So I didn't spend an awful lot of time in the drawing room because that was reserved for the adults.
Would it have been possible to have interrupted your mother when she was working?
No.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Shirley was born in 1930 and spent the early part of her childhood in this elegant Chelsea home.
How much has it changed?
Oh, hugely. I mean, for one thing, it's very much more light. Houses in those days in Chelsea were mostly quite dark. People hadn't got the idea of opening them out in the way that they have now. Chelsea in those days didn't just pretend to be inhabited by artists, it was inhabited by artists. So because it was a quiet street, artists used to actually paint with their easels up in the road. And the fun of it would be essentially looking at the curious characters that wandered down the street. I mean, artists who were tremendously showing off by wearing great berets on the side of their heads, or if they were women artists, huge hats. There was a street life which was very lively. I suspect now there's much less of a street life.
As a child, Shirley was immersed in political life, literally from the age of one, when she was pushed in a pram by her father during his campaign as a Labour candidate in the 1931 election. She became a Labour MP in 1964 and went on to hold ministerial positions in the Wilson and Callaghan governments, including Secretary of State for Education, where she is best remembered for her efforts to extend comprehensive schools. In the early 80s, she famously resigned from the Labour Party to form the SDP with three other colleagues. Together, they became known as the Gang of Four. This year, aged 81, she was instrumental in persuading the government to rethink large elements of its NHS reforms. Shirley grew up with success. The accomplishments of her left-wing intellectual parents, the political scientist George Catlin and the feminist writer Vera Brittain, dominated the Chelsea house.
My mother had just written Testament of Youth, which was her most famous book and which sold many millions of copies about the First World War. My father was travelling extensively lecturing, so they lived a fairly high-profile life. They were both quite, well, she particularly was quite a famous person.
So she was the breadwinner. She earned more than your father.
I think it was a huge discrepancy, but there was certainly a discrepancy. She would go on quite long, roughly sort of month-long speaking tours in the United States, wonderfully formal. I mean, she would travel by a Cunard liner. I remember we children used to go down to Southampton to see her off. People would come up and graciously offer my mother their books to be signed and that kind of thing.
The drawing room where we're in now, were there gatherings, parties where well-known people would gather?
Two sets, really. And tea was a great place to be hospitable. So quite often you'd have a small gathering, maybe only another friend or three or four friends, who would come and arrive at about four. Then you would have party parties, which would be at six, cocktail parties. Quite a few people would come to parties here, other writers and so forth. Quite a lot of women were emerging at that time. Phyllis Bentley, Storm Jameson, Rebecca West, well-known names of the 30s. And so my mother's feminism and her being an author mingled, so to speak. The two things came together.
One thing that struck me, you said in your autobiography that you knew your mother was very well known and very respected, but you weren't sure she was widely liked.
That's right. My mother was very candid. She was somebody who was unable to be anything except honest, literally unable to be. What that meant was, for example, if she met a fellow author and she thought he'd written a terrible book, she would say so. This is not exactly tactful.
So there was this very busy, serious-minded woman. How was she as a mother? Did she have a lot to do with you as a mother?
No, not really. Probably around about 6 o'clock when my mother stopped working and my father stopped working, we would come up to this drawing room and talk to them for maybe half an hour about what was happening at school and about our friends and so on. So I didn't spend an awful lot of time in the drawing room because that was reserved for the adults.
Would it have been possible to have interrupted your mother when she was working?
No.
This is the end of section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo skupaj z ocenjevalnim obrazcem položite na rob mize.
Nasvidenje in srečno!